title of the talk is a little bit provocative, but I think you'll find it's not that, my position isn't that radical, and in fact most of you will probably agree with me. First, as a prologue, I wrote up this opinion piece as a commentary and submitted it for publication. And in the commentary, I argued that much of the way statistical methods are used and described in biomedical research is inappropriate, or more importantly, it's bad for science. And the commentary was rejected because, as one referee said, this is well known. So I think there's a few lessons from this. First, the first lesson is that it's probably not publishable, but the second message is, and it's related to this talk, is what I'm going to say today isn't really new, but I think what I'm going to say today is important because there are still uses of statistical methods that I think are bad for science. And the third point is that the way I'm going to say it is a little bit stronger than the way it's been said before. So I'm against statistical inference, and I believe you are too. And you are, when you hear, you'll agree, I think, to be against statistical inference when you see how I'm defining statistical inference in a relatively narrow way. I'm defining it as the hypothesis testing paradigm of statistics. That is, you specify a null hypothesis in a proposed analysis, you collect data, you calculate a p-value, and if the p-value is less than some pre-specified cut point, usually 0.05, we reject the null hypothesis. And this leads to the mantra of the beginning biostatistics student, p less than 0.05, therefore we reject the null hypothesis. And we've all used this language, many of us have taught using this language. And in contrast, you might think of a different kind of inference, which I think is what most of us probably do. After calculating a p-value or other measure of evidence from our research, we might make a judgment about a hypothesis based on many considerations, such as biologic plausibility, previous research, and our current p-value. So we integrate the results from our current study with everything we've thought of or known or studied or read about before, and then we make a judgment about the hypothesis. Now, there are some advantages of using the pure statistical inference approach. As you've learned in your biostatistics class, if I use statistical inference at the 0.05 level and the null hypothesis is true, then I know there's only a 5% chance that I will incorrectly reject the null hypothesis. In other words, I have control over my error rate and my type 1 error rate. And that's an objective procedure. And we know that by mathematical properties that this is true, that we only reject 5% of the time. The disadvantage of this approach is that it ignores seemingly relevant considerations in a judgment about a hypothesis, obviously, prior data, biologic plausibility, and so on. Now, in contrast, or really conversely, the advantages of scientific inference, or the disadvantage of scientific inference is the opposite of the advantages of statistical inference. You have no control over error rates under a specified hypothesis, and scientific inference is subjective, but the advantage is it takes account of seemingly relevant considerations. Now, I would say that most people would agree that the disadvantages of statistical inference outweigh the advantages. I think, for example, few of us in our scientific work would take a single study that was motivated perhaps by previous studies or by our biological thought or other people's work and collect data, calculate a p-value, and immediately make a decision regarding whether the hypothesis is true or not, based on whether that p-value is less than 0.05. I don't think very many people would act that way. And in my view also, in fact, it would be unethical to act that way in a regulatory context, such as if you're the FDA trying to approve a drug or if you're the EPA trying to determine whether a chemical is a carcinogen and should be removed. In those situations, you need to take into consideration animal studies, biologic plausibility, other data, and so on. And they do that. Certainly the FDA and the EPA take into consideration those other things. So, if all of us act and agree, I can't really say you all would agree with me on this, but I think you probably do, that that we shouldn't use this pure statistical inference paradigm, what's the point of this talk? Well, the point of the talk is that many of us, though we kind of act in a certain way regarding scientific inference, we still use the language of statistical inference in our classes and in our papers, and we fail to appreciate the implications of being against statistical inference. So I'm going to talk about those implications right now. And also, not only do we fail to appreciate the implications, which really actually simplifies our lives as teachers and as scientists, also the language of statistical inference is pervasive, and I think it leads to scientific conclusions that are inconsistent with good scientific inference and, in fact, defy common sense. I once was thinking of writing a paper, Statistics and the Perversion of Common Sense, because many times the use of statistics, and I see this all the time in my students, kind of perverts normal, reasonable scientific judgment and statistical, and a big part of the reason for that is this language of statistical inference. So this is really the meat of the talk. We want to use scientific judgment in a judgment about hypotheses, and we want to integrate our data with data from previous studies, and we want to present that data to the scientific community so they can integrate it. What are the implications for our work? And here's a few of them. Implication one, the role of statistics in science, therefore, is not to accept or reject a hypothesis, but to quantify the strength of evidence in a study so that other scientists can integrate the new results with other information and make their own scientific judgments. So as writers of scientific publications, we need to be quantifying evidence, not saying we reject or accept, or not saying something is significant or not significant, p less than 0.05. So that leads to the recommendation that we should report exact p-values to summarize the evidence against the null hypothesis. And also, I'll talk about confidence intervals a little bit later. I'm not bringing them in at this stage, but they're also a useful tool in both in scientific inference. I'm also kind of confining myself to p-values here, although, like I'll mention later if I have time, there may be better measures of evidence. But if this should be the goal of a statistical analysis, to quantify evidence. And despite this, there tends to be very little discussion in statistical classes about what evidence is and how to quantify it. Implication two, it is not necessary to state in your papers, we consider a p-value less than 0.05 to be statistically significant. This statement is clearly unnecessary if we're going to report exact p-values, and p-values are viewed as a measure of the strength of evidence against a null hypothesis. This seems like a minor waste of space and papers, so it doesn't have great impact on scientific progress. But nevertheless, for some reason, many, many papers, in fact, the majority of papers, still contain a statement like this, which seems to me unnecessary. Here's another implication that really simplifies my teaching. Whether to use a one-sided or two-sided p-value is not an issue anymore, because whether to report a one-sided or two-sided p-value is analogous to the question of whether to report height in inches or whether to report height in centimeters. It really doesn't matter as long as the reader is told which scale is being used, because, again, the p-value is a measure of departure of your data from some null value, and you can convert a one-sided to a two-sided simply by doubling it. So really, it's not a big issue if you're viewing p-values as a measure of the strength of evidence. Despite this fact, the difference between one-sided and two-sided p-values is still thought of as a key topic in statistical education. There's still debates in the literature about which to use. Just last week, one of my colleagues at the University of Maryland called me and said he didn't know whether to use a one-sided or a two-sided, and what would the referees think if he used a one-sided, because that would give him a p-value less than 0.05. Would they think that was, you know, stretching the data or something like that? And I just told him it's like inches versus centimeters. Of course, he didn't like that answer. He still wanted me to tell him which one to use. Here's the most important one, I think, from a practical standpoint and from a scientific inference standpoint. This idea of adjusting for multiple comparisons is a real headache to a lot of us, and I think it perverts common sense. If you view the goal of statistical methods as quantifying evidence, it is not necessary in most situations to adjust inference for multiple comparisons. That is, if you are studying many, many research questions in the same study, you can summarize the evidence in the data with respect to each research question. You could use a p-value if you're using p-values to summarize evidence. And the fact that you looked at many comparisons does not really have an impact on the strength of evidence in your data set with respect to each particular hypothesis. Now, the common recommendation to worry about multiple comparisons is concerned with controlling the probability of incorrectly rejecting any null hypothesis in the study. So the common concern about multiple comparisons is based, I think, in the statistical inference paradigm, where we need to control type 1 error. Some people who are very concerned about type 1 error, but not only type 1 error for an individual question, but for the whole research project, which seems a little bit obsessive to me. At any rate, if we're not trying to control error rates, then our job as scientists is simply to report the strength of evidence with respect to each research question, and the nominal p-value does that. Despite this fact that it doesn't seem necessary our role is to quantify evidence, statistical guidelines that you'll read by statisticians who are trying to improve statistical practice often emphasize the need to adjust for multiple comparisons. And in fact, there's a set of ethical guidelines of the American Statistical Association, and they consider it unethical to fail to adjust for multiple comparisons. Okay, so now I'm going to give you a few examples of the way in which statistical inference can lead to scientific conclusions that defy common sense. You've probably seen this one before. This is an example where people kind of take this threshold of 0.05 a little bit too seriously. The language of statistical inference induces scientists to place undue emphasis on whether the p-value crosses an arbitrary threshold. As was reported by one statistician, a journal editor has confided that an author's thesis is undoubtedly true, but that the editor must reject the paper because the author's ideas are not supported by statistically significant results. So I think we've all kind of run into this issue that journals sometimes have this, they put too much emphasis on this arbitrary threshold of 0.05. Conversely, some scientists seem to think, or at least this one letter writer that was in the medical literature, seemed to think that if you get a p-value that's less than 0.05, you have to reject the null hypothesis. This is a quote. There is no justification whatever for the statement in their summary. So he's critiquing a paper. And in that paper, they said that the few other statistically significant associations between occupation and disease were thought to be due to chance. In making such a pronouncement, they automatically destroy the logic of practical statistical inference, one of the tenets of which is to say that given a certain probability level, we will believe that the results have not arisen by chance. So he thinks that statistics should dictate our beliefs, which, again, I think is not the role of statistics. Here's a third example. A study section that I was on reviewed a proposal that was designed to address a particular research question, and the applicants proposed to collect information on other outcomes at relatively little cost to address additional research questions. This is very typical. You have access to a source of data or a population. You're collecting data on one question. Well, it's relatively efficient to address other research questions, perhaps other exposures that might be related to the disease. This seemingly efficient approach was criticized by members of the panel because the inclusion of additional research questions would diminish the power for the original research question, and the grant was dinged by those reviewers. This seems to defy common sense, and rightfully so. It certainly is not consistent with scientific inference. So, as I alluded to before, if the role of statistical methods in science is to quantify evidence, then what's the best measure of evidence? That's a question that is really probably hasn't been studied as that much. And in this class, I've suggested p-values can be used. However, Royal and Goodman argue persuasively that in order to quantify evidence against a particular hypothesis, you must really specify an alternative hypothesis, and they recommend using a likelihood ratio. And I agree with that, although the p-values are much more entrenched at this point, so I'm not going to take that battle on at this point. And another complication is confidence interval. This talk is focused on assessment of hypotheses. However, estimation parameters is another important scientific activity. Confidence intervals can be viewed from the standpoint of a statistical inference as intervals formed by procedure that has known probabilities of covering the true parameter. I don't think that's a good way of looking at confidence intervals from a scientific standpoint. From a scientific standpoint, confidence intervals can be viewed as a set of parameter values that are consistent with the data, the set of parameter values compatible with any observed set of data. I think that's a much more useful way of thinking about confidence intervals from a scientific standpoint. Again, what I've said today is not new. You can read some. Here's three excellent papers that Jonathan Stern. I just reread this paper. It pretty much says what I just said. Gives some nice historical background in statistics and medicine. Steve Goodman has written on this extensively. This is a paper he wrote that I like. And the issue of multiple comparisons, I think, should have been put to rest by a nice paper by Savitz quite a while ago. In conclusion, I like this quote a lot by William Roseboom, a psychometrician. Who has ever given up a hypothesis just because one experiment yielded a test of statistic in the rejection region? Who's ever made a scientific decision simply based on a p-value? And what scientist in his right mind would ever feel there to be an appreciable difference between the interpretive significance of data for which a one-tailed p was 0.04 or 0.06, even though the significance had been set at 0.05? Nobody acts that way. In fact, you may not even worry about that. You may not think this is that important because you've never taken this method seriously, and that is true. We don't take this thing seriously. P less than 0.05, therefore we reject. However, we teach it. Not only do we teach it, but we, in some ways, act on it. So we teach students P is less than 0.05, therefore we reject the null. But in the words of Rosebaum, no scientist in his right mind would behave this way. It may seem just semantic, but this ritual and the narrow notion of statistical inference, in my opinion, exert an influence on the way we design, execute, interpret, and write about our research projects that is not in the best interest of science.